Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello, beautiful people. I am an ethical human being who would never claim that he was going to do one obligation for the show and then fail to do it.
We'll get that in a second. And here's Justin Robert Young.
Brian, you know who we are, right? Like, we are like notorious on the internet for saying one thing and then forgetting it and never doing it. Like, that's literally our lot in life.
All right.
That's our whole gag.
On the last episode of Weird Things, for those of you that are playing home along at home and want to follow along, we talked about the movie Ex Machina, which is getting a lot of buzz, a lot of critical praise because it deals with technology and it deals with artificial intelligence, which are issues we'll be talking about later on in the show. And we wanted to get into it, but not every party here had seen it at that point. And we made a promise on the show to go see it so we could discuss it.
Kind of a solemn vow, right?
On this very podcast, Brian vowed to see it.
Yeah.
And I vowed, and I take my word very seriously, guys. I'll have you know, I take my word very seriously. And I think, you know, a week was plenty of time to go see Ex Machina. I think any reasonable person would say a week was ample time to see it.
I mean, there's got to be like dozens of hours in that
and
week.
I think anybody who did not get that done in that amount of time should feel pretty horrible about it. So, Brian, did you see it?
I did go to the movie theaters.
Saw Ex Machina. Great. So we can carry on this discussion.
No, I kind of went and saw Mad Max, thinking that maybe I would catch Ex Machina like some other time. But then I went and saw Mad Max, and I'm real sorry about that. But you saw Ex Machina though, right? You
Brian,
kept your promise.
I made a promise to this microphone that I would go see Ex Machina. I take my word very, very seriously because the last thing I wanted to do was to be in front of this audience right here and to look like a liar, to look like somebody who didn't deliver,
right.
To look like how you look right now in letting everybody down, Brian, everybody down.
So that's why you definitely saw it, right?
Because that would be the reason to go see it, Brian.
So you're saying you didn't see Mad Max?
Brian, I didn't say anything yet.
Oh.
What was the question?
Did you see
Ex Machina?
Yeah.
Andrew, you promised you were going to see Ex Machina. We all promised we're going to see Ex Machina because people tune in to this
podcast.
We're
going to table that to talk about how awesome Mad Max was.
About not only...
So I didn't see it either. I saw Mad Max and I was like, I've been in this writing tear. It's great. I love the book I'm writing. And I'm not going to, the only thing I need to do this week is see Ex Machina. And then I hear people talking about how great Mad Max is. And I'm like going a little stir crazy here going, I think I got to see Mad Max because otherwise I'm going to be sitting in front of the keyboard thinking about Mad Max.
Well, that's what ultimately tipped me over was like Ex Machina sounds like, you know, whatever window there was for initial excitement has already passed. So there's really not a big difference between us seeing it this week and next week. However, Mad Max, we had a chance to be part of that first weekend wave and I couldn't resist that pull.
Like what you were feeling, I was dreading. You understand, I got up this morning, like I was looking at movie times to see if I could see Ex Machina before the podcast. I woke up, I'm like, man, I could probably almost make it, you know, and I'm like, because I don't want to have to deal with, you know, telling you guys that I didn't.
That you failed us. Yeah, no, well, I felt less guilty than you because apparently with my co-junkie, Justin Robert Young, we've had a taste of failure fever for a while. And so admitting that I didn't do the thing I promised to do didn't terrify me as much as it did you. However, does that mean that all three of us saw Mad Max and we could talk about Mad Max because Mad Max?
Justin?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right.
Justin, like the folks at home hadn't heard that you also saw it. So,
yeah, I had set up. I heard that he was going to see it. He did not tell me that he did see it. So,
yeah, dude.
I saw it.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Right on.
Okay. Wow. Your enthusiasm is just infectious here.
Okay. So, I guess I'll go first. I was unprepared for how much it owned the unique aspects of cinema and film, where it's like where set pieces and visual composition matter so much. Clever spaces, whether they made sense or not. The opening was such an amazing sucker punch to the gut that just didn't even stop. And then 10 minutes in, you're just like, oh my God. And then it's like, oh, by the way, this is Mad Max Fury Road, just FYI. Yeah. And I mean, I was like, I loved it. And
in case you forgot what theater you walked into,
yeah.
You know, we're going to remind you just so you know what movie, because this is not Pitch Perfect, guy.
Here's
the tattoo torture scene in Pitch Perfect, totally different.
Its real gift is, to me, what I'm always seeking in a movie is the ability to be completely swept away to where stuff can make no sense whatsoever, and I can honestly, in my heart of hearts, not care at all. And I always use, like, Men in Black as an example of that, because, like, it's got the dumbest crap ever in Men in Black, but I buy it. It's like, I bought the ticket, I'm there for the ride. And for me, there were two moments that stuck out. When you see the dude with his eyeballs poked out, whose only joy in life is to thrash on the front of this death machine at the front of a parade while drummers...
The doof wagon.
Dude, it was amazing, right? And it's like, yeah, of course that guy would exist. And of course this would be part of that world. And then the other thing is like...
You know he has a whole backstory.
Oh, does he?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Walk me through this. How do you know about all this?
Because after I saw Mad Max, I'm like, I need to know everything about this Fury Road. So nicknamed the scary guitar guy. So his official name is Coma Doof Warrior, right? So he was like a blind guy, Gordon Miller, living in a cave, living off rats, surviving, but was making music while he was in there, like, you know, playing around with rocks, things, doing whatever he could to do that. And a Morton Joe comes walking by, strutting by. Here's the music. Here's the sound coming from here. And it's like, you get to be part of what I'm doing. They pull him out of the cave. They slap an electric guitar into his hand, put him on the doof wagon with the guys playing the drums. Because guess what? Roman legions going into battles, drummers. You know, it's a common thing.
Dude,
you know,
freaking Revolutionary War. You got fife players at the front and drum corps and bannermen.
Vietnam
and all that
War,
nonsense.
Airborne cavalry, Ride of the Valkyries.
It's psychological warfare. That's important, and obviously in this world more important than ever. The other moment that I realized I bought an insane ticket was when you spend like half the movie with these giant whip antennas being on all the vehicles, and then the last half of the movie when they're used to snatch people out of other vehicles and put people on them back and forth, and I was like, oh, that makes total sense. Of course, that's why you would have whip antennas with people on the ends of it. I'm there.
It's go ahead, Justin.
If you look at that, like, even. And drawing the corollaries between like medieval warfare and you know different elements of you know having bands and stuff like that, like if it kind of just seems like that's what it would make sense if you had a bunch of you know glue sniffers that were designing kind of siege warfare sort of medieval grade sort of technology that like well listen there's these things with spikes on it we got to get around the spikes somehow so we'll have these things that go over the top, you know, in that world, it just made such delightful sense.
You know, when Gore Verbinski and crew decided to make the Lone Ranger movie based upon the success of the Pirates of the Caribbean franchise, they said, oh, let's see if we can't kind of create a franchise based in the West. And that becomes evident when you look at when they have these sequences with trains passing each other and going in and around in all sorts of ridiculous ways. They're trying to recreate, you know, the sailing vessels and stuff and naval warfare in this very way that does not work at all. Yet here you look at it and you're like, oh man, this is like a pirate story in effect, you know, set out in the desert. And instead of swinging for masts, they created, you know, Miller created this brilliant, brilliant. And they actually got Cirque du Soleil people to do that stuff, by the way.
Did they? That makes total sense. So, Here's what's weird is I actually I couldn't help but read a couple of reviews here or there just because I wanted to synthesize what other people thought and see if somebody had novel observations that I missed. But the complaint And I guess it's a legitimate complaint. Somebody had an article titled Why the Road Warrior is Better Than Mad Max Fury Road. And it ends up, it's a very high praise article for Fury Road. But you could tell, like, at the end of the day, his thesis was, I preferred the intimacy of the characters from the Road Warrior. It was a small outpost. They're valued. You know, they didn't have giant gushing waterfalls of water. They had a single pump, and that mattered in that world. He's just saying he liked that better. But sure.
That sounds to me like Hugh Hefner ranking orgies.
Yeah.
It's just like, well, you know, I preferred the one during Memorial Day in 76 to the one in 85. Really, when you think about it, it was more intimate.
Exactly. Well, and so one of the things he said that I do think is right, and I also don't mind, is that the Road Warrior still very much felt connected to our world. In fact, if I remember correctly, the Road Warrior was the one that started with a voiceover explaining, like, you know, and the politicians talked, and they talked, and they talked, and then the war happened, and all that stuff. Whereas this is as though it's another world. You know, their Australian accents are all over the map, and the images are so much larger than life, which I loved. You know, it's like, you know, we live in a different age of special effects where CG, you know, can be used or overused or underused. Like that sandstorm that they drove into was terrifying. It was bigger than anything I imagined we would see on Mars. It was unreal. It was otherworldly. Watching four stilted walkers tread over poisoned swamplands, you know, in this haunted dark blue nightscape. It was great. And I didn't mind. I do understand what you're saying, where it's like we lose that connection to our world right now, but I'm okay with that.
I think that, you know, and if you look at the oeuvre of the Mad Max series, where you start with Mad Max, which takes place after something bad has gone or we're in this decline. And one of the things I loved about Mad Max was the idea that civilization is still kind of trying to function. There are ice cream parlors and mechanic shops. There's the Hall of Justice, but the J is falling down. It's almost Terry Gilliam-esque in that way, you know, that things work. And then on the fringes, we're still, and that's the thing, when the apocalypse happens, folks, there's going to be people trying to put parking tickets on your car. You know, that's going to happen. And then when you go to Road Warrior, Mad Max, you know, Road Warrior, the United States, Mad Max 2, you get this. This is 5 years down the road. The things have pretty much fallen apart completely. You know, Max just sort of, you know, had already left that. And you get the gangs that you saw in the first one are now, there's no more cities to go terrorize. You know, you have to find these little community after community. And then you jump forward years to beyond Thunderdome. And you get
which is society
these communities
and civilization
starting to erupt.
Right, right. You get a second rebirth of civilization and even bureaucracy, you know, mm-hmm. the laws from within. You break the deal, you spin the wheel, and so on.
And that's what I read. One of the things I thought was really brilliant was somebody pointed out that what makes Miller's stuff so interesting, he's not just trying to tell you a story of people trying to survive after it, which is what we get a lot, Walking Dead, all that, which is interesting. He's going and saying, okay, what comes next? What groups and stuff comes up afterwards? And you look at one of the endearing themes, I mean, not so much in Thunderdome, but really in Road Warrior and Mad Max, was the bad guys have very, very tight bonds with their people. They have love. They talk about trying to redeem them, each other. They want to try to pull them back in the fold when they stray. They really are tribal. They really, really are tribal. And you have if they're the bad guy because you know, the way when if you're not in their tribe, it's bad. And that's one of the things I thought was just, you know, compelling. Oh, I have a little brother and he was perfect.
Yeah.
By the way, this is the point in which we probably belatedly remind everybody that this will be a spoiler filled discussion of this movie. So please go see the movie. If you don't want to be spoiled, then you should probably turn off the podcast and you probably have already been spoiled. However,
oh, we're going to spoil you, all
well,
right.
But also, it's, I mean, here's the good news is, I mean, what's there to spoil is...
I actually take... I mean, if we are in a community of lovers about this movie, there are two things that I kind of find not invalid, but interesting to me discussion-wise around this movie. A, that it's an unapologetic hour and a half chase sequence, for which I think it's not wrong to call it that, but I do think it's a lot more than that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And that there, you know, you I think it's interesting to say that Imperator Furiosa is the protagonist of the movie, but I don't know if she's any more of the protagonist than Mad Max or really the War Boy, for whom has maybe the most complete arc in the entire the entire movie.
Can we go? Okay, so let's go in stages of simplicity. The more simple one is I do adore the fact that Imperator Furiosa is, I think she is clearly the protagonist of the movie. I feel like Max is our link to the story. He's the narrator. He's the eyes that we see everything through. And he does play a role, a significant role, not a huge role in the story, but the surprise. And again, to me, you know, that's the heart of great movies is surprise, is War Boy not only surviving, but becoming a deeply sympathetic character by the end. Like I bought his entire arc and I thought he was a throwaway. I thought he was, he only served to make us understand that this was a heartless, cruel society that chewed up young testosterone like him, you know?
Yeah, it was. And that's you find those elements in some of the other movies that he's done along these lines. And it was, and that was one of the beauties of this. It was that you had, you know, you had Mad Max, you know, you had Furiosa, you had Nux, the War Boy, and then you had the bride's Capable, Toast, yellow ones. Like Capable, I think Capable's the redheaded one. And you see, even though they have small parts, they still have their own little arcs, and you see that, and you see the little bits of humanity.
Absolutely. There is more personality, and I feel like this is going to, just because I've talked to both of you guys about it, we're eventually going to get into a lot of comparisons to other movies, especially where this movie does a lot of things really, really well, where other movies maybe it did not. There is more personality in the brides that they are running from point A to point B than all of the dwarves in The Hobbit in all 9 hours.
Absolutely.
They had to develop literally anything. And we get all that personality in maybe what, a combined 30 lines of dialogue between the five of them?
Well, and part of it is how stark the contrast of the beauty of these women to the landscape that it's in there. And it's so decadent. It's such a great surprise. And again, just spoiler, sorry, I'm looking over at our producer, Bryce Neshkam Castillo, ruining the movie for you right now.
Yep.
the like after 20 or 30 minutes of this cold, hard, hateful, desiccated, filthy, boil-ridden, tumor-laden landscape to suddenly have Max look up after freeing himself, you know, still with the mask on for whatever is, and that was another moment where it's like, yeah, use a man to, you know, drain blood from him so you can get an extra benefit while you're driving. Of course, I buy it. Why not?
And yeah, then I'm on board.
And he looks up and it's like, not only are they gorgeous and beautiful and clean, but they are frolicking in the water, this decadent use of water in this sand landscape. I just remember thinking, I was like, turn off the hose. You got to turn off the hose. There's so much water you're wasting. Stop, stop. What are you doing?
And this is something that he's probably not seen in a decade.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was, I felt it. And I maybe that's what I could say about the movie in general is that, to me, a good movie supersedes logic. It supersedes whatever, even my exterior beliefs. You know, like I could be a crazy libertarian in the outside world, but the right movie can have me cheering for the crazy socialist on the movie,
Dave,
or whatever. You know, it's like Dave, yeah, sure. And this movie did it, man. It cast its spell.
And I think that, like, you know, people can, like, you want this has a 98% critic score on Rotten Tomatoes, which is insane. Okay, and whenever you get that, you're going to get the people who then are going to dive in to find faults. And yes, there are faults to be found. There are faults to be found in everything. And that's my thing is, like, yes, show me something that's fault free now.
But by the way, understand, like, and this is part of the metagame between, like, Rotten Tomatoes. All they do is they say thumbs up or thumbs down, generally positive, generally negative of all the reviews. And 98% of them are generally positive. The double whammy is when you go and you look at Metacritic.com. Metacritic, it has Mad Max Fury Road is 89% is the overall the overall combination of
What Metacritic does is extrapolate everybody with any kind of like score, basically. So if you have a 4-star, it extrapolates that into whatever 100% would be and averages everything together, and it gets 89, which is
exactly
very, very hard. I mean, like, just like 100% on Rotten Tomatoes is obviously very, very difficult, but not really that impossible, considering when you look at how few, I mean, there's really only like a couple dozen reviewers that they pull in that generates their critic score. To do something over 80% on Metacritic is impossible.
For example, Finding Nemo is 99% positive. So it's like everybody liked Finding Nemo, not a lot of people loved Finding Nemo, right? Whereas that's what's extraordinary about Mad Max is that 89% people not only liked it, but they liked it a lot.
Well, no, again, I mean, that factors in. If somebody gave it 3 out of 4 stars and saying, well, I love it, I love it, I love it, but there was this one thing that prevents it from me giving it a perfect rating, that goes in as the extrapolated from you know, three-fourths, it's 75% on Metacritic, right. You know?
Yeah.
So, you know, and with that, and I read a criticism of someone who's like, it's feminist propaganda. I'm like, listen, if this is hyper-feminist propaganda and it involves guns, law and justice, vigilantism, all that, sign me up, sister.
I now, obviously, that was an intentional decision. But who honestly could be against that position? I mean, it was like, it was a wonderful movie.
I hesitate to even delve into this argument. It's pointless. It's so silly. At some point, it's like, dude, if you're looking for like, man, why don't they make action movies the way they used to? It's like, dude, this is better than most of the action movies that you were going to hold up and say, you know, I wish they made them like they used to. This is good as it gets.
You know, you get the problem we live in is we live in an age where people want to judge the worth of something by its box office. You know, and that's how you can either say, well, critically it does this, or box office it does this. Or you can go like, yeah, but I really liked it. Everybody else is too dumb to like it. Now, Mad Max in the United States came out up against Pitch Perfect, which, you know, was the first one did really well. That franchise is doing really good. And it's going to have legs, though. Internationally, Mad Max has been doing really good. I've been present for 4 conversations whenever a movie's been brought up, not by my friends, but just in random places, Popeye's Fried Chicken, wherever. Mad Max, I'm Popeye's. Guy next to me is talking to his daughter, explaining Mad Max. I go to my Greek restaurant today, getting a drink. Mom says, yeah, Daddy saw Mad Max last night, saw this. I had 2 people on Friday say, oh, I heard this NPR interview review about Mad Max, you know, and they said, they quoted the same thing where the review said, you know, it opens with the best car chase in cinematic history, and the end of it, they have the second best car chase in cinematic history.
It's insane. Now let's get into what I found to be a moment that it is a tribute to this movie that we get so far into talking about it without mentioning something that I have never seen before. Now, meanwhile, at the end of like the first third of this movie, I was watching it with Ashley and our friend Brett the Amtrak Aronsonville. And I just said to him, this is the wildest S I have ever seen in my entire life. You know, that was like just where at the first act, right? And then they do something that I can't remember in a movie that is a crowd-pleasing film that requires the audience's buy-in I can ever remember seeing. They run over a pregnant woman.
Dude.
Like, in the movie, right? Now, there's like that old adage in Hollywood, don't shoot the dog. But I assume that don't shoot the dog is like, that's $5 to the $100 of like, no, and of course you don't run over a pregnant woman. Like, violence to women in movies in general, even kind of hardcore, you know, big stakes, people are evil kind of, you know, movies. Like, there's usually a lot of qualifications. And obviously this villain is about as evil and despicable as you can possibly think, but even then, like, for a beautiful pregnant woman to be run over, and then what happens to her afterward, let alone, like, holy smokes, that just kind of that blew me out of the theater.
I'll tell you what else is I did find it fascinating that our introduction to the antagonist is with him. We see him at his weakest, at his most honest, at his most vulnerable. Basically, it's like meeting Darth Vader first as the dying old man on the exploding Death Star, and then watching him put on the armor and put on the act of being Darth Vader for everyone else, which I can't think of another movie where that's been a strong opening for an antagonist.
There's a prequel comic coming out that explains his backstory, which I'm cool, but I kind of, like, I was joking to a friend of mine. I said, you know, I'd like to imagine that Immortan Joe is a middle school teacher somewhere coaching girls soccer.
Right now, yeah.
Yeah, right now. You know, right now. And then he gets called into the principal's office, like, we've heard something about inappropriate comments. And he looks out through the windows and he sees a mushroom cloud.
Yeah.
And he just pushes the desk away, gets up, walks over to the Pee Wee football locker room, says, you guys, come with me.
Yeah.
That's the last we see of him until this movie starts.
But you know, that is, and again, like, this movie works if you just want an hour and a half action, like, mm-hmm. sequence, right? Like, there's a lot, there is more than enough to satisfy you if that's what you're going in there for. But, like, there, as a script, there is so little wasted. Like, every action kind of has a purpose, including showing him being so frail. Really, like, the overarching theme of the movie is, you know, you're more powerful than you think. The people that are above you, that hold this power, are more vulnerable than you might think. And every character, as they, you know, it takes until all three of them are on board, you know, the war boy, Furiosa, who leads everything by kind of making the decision to run the brides, and Mad Max in deciding that he wants to be part of this final mission before they realize, like, oh, no, wait, we can just run right back at him and you know, try to, hit him at the pass, and we can basically overrun the Citadel. You know, he's weak. He is a straw man in so many ways, which is why he has to overcompensate for running down, you know, these brides, two of which have his legitimate heirs.
He's Oz.
But yes, very much so. And wears that on his sleeve. I think that's a good comparison. I did not realize this until Tanky in the chat just started pointing it out. But, you know, I went and saw it at the Alamo Drafthouse, and they actually had George Miller and the guy who plays who's the bad guy again?
Hugh Keynes.
Yeah, on there. But what's interesting is they introduced him as the guy who played Toe Cutter, and I didn't realize that you mm-hmm. had the same actor playing two different villains in the same universe. Like I'm just finding this out for the first time. That's amazing.
Yeah, he that was kind of cool to have him come back. You know, bring him back into, like, Bruce Spence, but who. Hugh Caseburn, you know, Bruce Spence, who played two different characters who looked a lot alike and acted very, very similar between Road Warrior and Thunderdome. But yeah, Toe Cutter was originally in Mad Max. He was the leader of the gang. And what's interesting about the making of Mad Max is he is a theater actor, and many of the people that were in his biker gang were theater actors too, and they hung out and behaved like bikers and behaved like a gang. And just see, you know, which, and they basically, the police gave them passes that explained they were making a movie, which they used as get out of jail free cards.
Oh, that's amazing.
That's great.
So one of the things, as you know, the Alamo Drafthouse does a good job on their pre-show. You always want to show up like a half hour to 40 minutes early so that you could see all the other related clips that they've been able to cobble together. I expected to see in their pre-show a bunch of trailers for, you know, Road Warrior, Mad Max, and all that stuff. But what I didn't realize is what a pervasive genre this whole dystopian, you know, guzzling, you know, open seas of the desert sci-fi hellscape was in the late 70s, early 80s. There must have been like seven different movies that I had never heard of. And unfortunately, I can't access the name for them now, but there was an awful lot of them. It was freaking amazing.
I mean, there was, you know, I would say that they're Mad Max started a genre. Now, you had the desert decay post-apocalyptic thing in the original Planet of the Apes, you know, and like Logan's Run TV series and stuff. But really, Mad Max was the one of, like, with the idea of the vehicles and the bikes and all that sort of thing, I think really created that. And then Road Warrior sold it. And once Road Warrior, again, you know, Mad Max, Road Warrior, Thunderdome, and then Fury Road, which sort of exists. It's a reapproach towards it. So it doesn't invalidate the other ones, but it doesn't mean it's canon. The other ones are, there's a strict linearity to them. But anyhow, yeah, it absolutely created its own, like, Blade Runner inspired things and Alien did and Star Wars.
By the way,
real quick, before we dive even further into this, who runs Patreon Town? You, the patrons, run Patreon Town. Head on over to patreon.com/weirdthings to support this show, including the freewheeling nature, which allows us to discuss everything from science to pop culture, including this extra long take at Mad Max Fury Road. And also, as you can see in Brian's chat right now, the fruits of your labor are hard at work as we speak with Bryce Castillo, making sure that we stay on topic and keep rocking and rolling. So thank you to everybody who supports us. And if you would like to toss us a few coins or maybe gallons of water or some gasoline or head gasoline to the bullet farm, head on over to patreon.com/weirdthings.
We're fine, and we are ka-chunk.
You know, and the reason we're discussing this, by the way, is that it is very, very interesting science fiction. Obviously, it's fanciful in the directions it goes into, but guess what, folks? We do live in a day and age when there are warlords out in the desert capturing women to use as sex slaves, fighting over scarce resources. It's disturbing in 2015 how, and you look at the war boys and you look at how they buy into this, and you want to analyze ISIS or Boko Haram and try to get an understanding of why these things are so pervasive. You know, well, when you're in the middle of nowhere, you're in the middle of these other places, and you don't have a lot of options, those things seem very attractive. And, you know, and the idiots here who fall into the romanticism and want to go support that cause, God help them. But
I'll tell you what, it's difficult for us, especially those of us listening, not that we're all in the West, but many of the folks listening right now are of Western culture where, you know, the internet rules supreme and we have access to information. You know, you look at the war boy and you're like, well, how could you fall for a shabby knockoff of Nordic mythology? Because you've been fed nothing else. Also, please spray chrome spray paint in your mouth to get high right now. You know, and there are still pockets, big pockets of the very real world where people are only fed one flavor of crazy, and they buy it, well, you know, lock, stock, and barrel. Well,
and as we go towards our own election season and you start watching the reasons in which we champion our guy over your guy or woman or our girl or whatever, your boy or whatever, kind of, you know, we start, you know, getting into this sort of, my chieftain's better than your chieftain because blah, 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 blah. We're all part of that. You know, we're not that surface far removed.
Especially, you know, when you look at, and this is, I think, what makes this world so sticky is scarcity and indoctrination and their relationship with each other is something that is universal. You know, like if you, you know, what is the line between, you know, thematically when we look at the most, you know, the emotional underpinnings of Mad Max Fury Road's, you know, Citadel encampment and the unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, you know, like they are these kind of similar ideas, obviously taken to radically different points. But like there's a reason why we find these stories interesting and compelling is because on some level we can understand that we are not as far away from these people, despite the fact that they are radically different in their behavior and motivations.
I think that, yeah, when you get into that sort of the cult psychology of where people move towards them or want to be part of it. And you can see it in physical examples, like you said. And then you can see it like, well, I have a Facebook group and we like to talk about this political thing, you know, and it's like,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, these are the jokes that are OK here. Oh, no, you're not part of the group. You're out of the group. Oh, I'm blocking you or I'm this or that. And you look at how we start to exclude and we start to indoctrinate ourselves. That was such a listen, if you can't see people, if you can't see the character complexities and arcs in Mad Max Fury Road, I'm sorry. They're there. They're very much there.
And even the parallels to, you know, modern society right now. I mean, it's like in many ways, 10 years ago, it would be more difficult to swallow the ridiculous aesthetic based tribalism nature. It's like you have cars that are all covered with spikes. You have, you know, it's like, oh, well, you know, in our tribe, we love death metal. What do you love? Oh, you love sitar music? Screw you. You know, whatever. And yet on the internet, as we're able to see increasingly outrageous splintering of groups and social norms within internet society, I don't know. It makes me believe even more in this weird postmodernist, ridiculous space opera of a real life in Australia.
Can we talk about the acting real quick?
Yeah.
In this movie? Because I thought it was exceptional. And really, is there anything Charlize Theron can do?
Dude, she certainly closed the book on that. Like, everything she did up until then, like, also going to shave my head, going to portray an amputee who's a badass, you know, war machine.
I didn't realize until I watched the movie that she was an amputee, and it wasn't going to be like, oh, no, she has an arm, but she has a stronger mech arm, you know, because it just makes sense to when you are that kind of, in that job. Like, no, this is like... She is maybe as mangled. I mean, certainly is prettier in the face than she was during Monster or something. But like, she is certainly not. She is about as unpretty as somebody who is like a legitimate fashion model, like Charlize Theron kind of naturally is. But holy, I mean, she's like.
To me, it's a testament to the completeness of the devastation of this world. The fact that nobody gets out on. There is not a single whole being in this entire movie. Mad Max is psychologically destroyed. He's literally the most insane you've ever seen, man. He's literally mad. Charlize Theron, you know, the protagonist who's badass, she's missing an arm. War Boy, you know, names his tumors. The brides are woefully ignorant and incomplete psychologically. You know, they live in this bubble, and everybody's broken in this world. And it makes there's a symmetry and a balance and a completeness to it that I really, really dug.
She was awesome. Yeah. I love that. Like, hey, spoiler alert! In this far, we don't find out why she's got that robo hand. Just a thing. It's just a thing she has, which makes it all the more awesome that it's like.
But and what a testament to, again, this is the spell cast over me in the audience. I didn't care. It's like, course you've got a robot arm. How else are you going to drive? Oh, and then plus also this whole idea of like, we don't have keys to our cars. You grab, your own personal steering wheel, lock it in. And then it makes it. Yeah, of course. That makes sense. It's like grabbing a flight suit. You're a pilot. You are getting in your X-Wing and going out into the sea of space of the desert.
I think there's. Like I it's to the point where like now I don't know even what else, like I don't know what I would be most excited to see her in. I mean, besides obviously just another Mad Max movie, which like have we heard anything sequel talk about it? Because this was a movie that had tremendous problems in terms of its production and apparently had great personal disdain between
and
Charlize Theron and George Miller, the director. It was, you know, it shot for a little while, stopped shooting, had to finish up shooting afterward. I wonder what the threshold is going to be financially for them to go do another one.
Well, this is the problem, right, is that as artistically much of a slam dunk as this is, it doesn't sound like it's, you know, it sounds like you can get a bunch of girls singing and make more money on the same weekend that you release this. You know, it's it,
no, although I think it's at, I mean, listen, whatever the budget came in at is whatever the budget came in at, right? Like, and that's its own kind of math that the studio is going to look at. But what else do we really expect from a Mad Max hard R super violent movie to open? I mean, like, for it to come in at, like, what was it, 45, 50 million for the weekend? Like,
not a bad start at all.
That's exceptional. Like what are the other expectations for it?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's worldwide, like I said, worldwide, it's very, very promising for what it's been able to do. It's had a very good opening internationally. You know, the question people are asking is, you know, what's next week? And I mean, like, the next big action thing is San Andreas. And, you know, is word of mouth going to get people here? And we've seen some examples of people, of movies that keep going. The buzz on this is great. You know, we fought for Dread, trying to tell people to go see Dread. And there's still, maybe we might get another Dread because, you know, but it did really good video. But this, I think that, you know, this could be Warner Brothers. You know, Warner Brothers wants franchise picks. Batman Begins did not do super huge compared to other superhero franchises. Batman Begins was not a titanic success compared to others, but it was critically praised, and it built and built and did great on home video enough that they said, "Nah, let's go all in on this Dark Knight." And I think that, you know, Miller says he's got other stories he wants to do. So I think that, you know, chances are good. And listen, you know, there's always other stories. There's always other screenplays if there's checks on the table. I mean, that's just, you know, it's.
Well, yeah, I guess the question is how well does it, you know, how well does it have to do it? And, you know, is it something that, you know, Tom Hardy made a real public point to apologize to George Miller at the Cannes Film Festival and let him know that he was even more brilliant than he had thought he was, and apologize for his actions in shooting. That does not.
By the way, I'm ignorant as to what the behind the scenes scuttlebutt was. I paid no attention to the gossip on this.
Well, all I know is that in following this movie, just kind of in, you know, the movie sites that report this kind of stuff, this had all the hallmarks of what's the Terry Gilliam
The Man of La Mancha thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, this smelled of Man of La Mancha like 2 years ago. Like they shot it, they stopped shooting. It was apparently like a very troubled shoot that you know, apparently went over budget. So it was like you know, to the point where it just got shut down. So there was this sense that, you know, maybe we'll never. Maybe, you know, they said they were going to do reshoots, but there's, you know, Hollywood has a lot of movies that, you know, maybe we'll go finish at some point, or they just recut what they shot and release it, even though it sucks, to try to cash in on, make some money back on what they spent. This had all that. They wound up, you know, I guess the promise of what they initially shot was enough for them to go back and finish it. But, it apparently was a lot of also just personal animosity between Tom Hardy and
George Miller.
George Miller.
Wow.
We'll see. I think, again, the overseas is promising. It didn't have, you know, the 44 million is obviously would be wonderful to have a much bigger opening for that. But the word of mouth on this has been fantastic. The next week is Poltergeist in Tomorrowland. So, you know, we'll see. Some people are saying Tomorrowland will have a big opening.
The likelihood that this movie just hangs out in the top five for a couple weeks, I think, is very high. It's got a very, very, very big word of mouth. It's got, I mean, it's the first movie in a while that I can remember it being not like a, you know, you got to see it because there's tie-ins or, you know, there's another kind of obligation to see it. But just in that, like, hey, do you want, like, a pure oxygen breath of fresh air at the movies, go see this movie.
Well, and that's the thing is I can't remember the last time. I think Avatar might be the last time that the pitch was flat and definitive that it's like, if you're ever going to see this movie, you need to see it while it's still at the theater because it will not be the same once it's not. And by the way, did either of you guys see it in 3D?
I did.
There was a brief moment I kind of, there was one like obvious pandering, like this is a 3D moment.
The scene at the end?
I don't know, where something was blown. I think you see like the steering wheel fly out and hover in front of you.
That's the final, after the big explosion, get both the guitar and the steering wheel, like, in your face.
Yeah, Which, to be honest, I remember that was the first time maybe ever in my life that I was like, aw, I kind of wish I was having this in 3D right now.
I was the other kind of like, your CGI had been so seamless.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, no, that's the first time that it did kind of break out. Everything else was very subtle. But watching it in 3D as they went into the sandstorm, I bet was fantastic.
I only saw it in 3D because it was in the big theater of Grand Lake, and I like that big theater. And more than anything, it just kind of fit time-wise for when we were going to go. But I would prefer to have seen it in 2D. 3D does nothing for me. I would prefer if we could all just take a vote as an audience and say, yeah, no, we'll play 3D prices. Can we just see it in the big theater at the time we want?
And, you know, interesting is that I talked to a theater owner, and he was explaining to me that one of the ways that the studios try to control things is, because one thing too, it's like, you know, you get into like, we've had this discussion before, like, oh, no, this movie made back its money because I looked at Box Office Mojo and it said it made $160 million and it cost $150. Well, guess what? That's not counting what the theaters get paid. They're not a charity. Number two, it's not cost, you know, it doesn't count what they paid on marketing and all those other costs. Those numbers they're instructive, but they're not informative. You know, they're part of it, but they're not the whole picture. But one of the ways that, like, you know, I have heard like some of the release, they, you know, like the movie, the studios get like 90% the opening weekend or whatever. I don't know quite how it works.
I mean, it's ridiculous. Like if you've ever worked in a movie theater, you know that they're not joking when they say all the money they make is on Snickers and popcorn.
It changed like second week, third week. That's why like the theaters, like studios would love to keep them out there, but theaters will push them out because, you know, okay, but anyhow, point is like it's a complicated formula. But one of the things I've heard is that studios mandate the number of 3D screenings. They will say that, like, I heard that, like, Avengers 2, it was Disney said it's got 75% of the show times have to be 3D.
Oh, my God.
Which it's like, I got a notice from El Capitan, like, hey, come see, you know, Avengers 2 at the El Capitan, which is the Disney owned theater. I'm like, great. And guess what? It's going to be in 3D and real 3D.
Like, you know, I don't,
what is that, by the way? Real 3D.
Just a proprietary, different form, you know.
I will say this: in terms, if you either like 3D or are forced to see it in 3D, it's and you don't get the chance to go see it in digital 3D, which is to me the only like 3D that I can tolerate more than the other one, just because the digital projection is brighter, so it kind of adjusts for the fact that 3D prints are usually muddy because you're watching it through these glasses. Colors are so vibrant in this movie that I didn't notice the non-digital projection in 3D.
So I saw it in 2D digitally projected, but what was interesting was I saw a lot of compression artifacts. It looked like I was watching 1080 and not 4K. And really? I saw it at the Arclight in Hollywood in the Cinerama Dome, which is, you know, a premier place to see it. And there are a lot of scenes where I'm looking at sort of the contrast, things like that. I'm going, man, is that a camera artifact? Is that a...
Yeah, I'll tell you what. It's nowadays, it sort of... I rue the day that I noticed that whenever you see any kind of straight-line font printed up on there, keep in mind, a lot of the 4K projectors that you have that are equipped for 3D, and again... apologies if I'm getting any of the details wrong, but as I understand it, they could be equipped for 4K, but then when they do 3D projections, they're doing 2K on each side. When they do 2D, they are only doing 2K on basically half the capacity. 2K is slightly above 1080p at home. And so as a result, if you sit in the front row, which me being somebody who usually comes in late for the movie, sitting in the front row, you're able to see artifacting on all the lines. You can see the individual pixels.
And actually, TVZ Gun's pointing out that most theaters are digital projection. What I'm referring to is digital IMAX. Like in that format is super, super bright and is better for 3D in my opinion. So yeah, that's what I was trying to say.
I don't like having stupid things on my face. I don't like 3D glasses.
It's just dumb. If it weren't for the fact that was the only chance that I would have seen it another way. But yeah, no, I'm totally with you. It adds nothing. And the one moment that was like that was like, oh, it's 3D. It was just like, all right, well, whatever, fine. I mean, okay.
Yeah. Gentlemen, so, I guess I know what our picks. Oh, what was it?
Yeah, I was about to say. So picks, we all pick Mad Max Fury Road.
Yeah.
Man, I guess I'll say what I'm reading right now. I'm not far enough into it to really know how to feel about it yet, but I'm reading. It's one of those things that I told myself I ought to do. It's one of those ought to do things on the list, and it took a while for me to get there. But I started reading Radley Balko's Rise of the Warrior Cop. That is much more comprehensive than I thought it was going to be. Part of it is, of course, you know, in the news. I don't know if you've been noticing on YouTube, Andrew, but there's a few video of people, you know, walking around with guns to see how the police react, whether they're white or black or whatever, including one I tweeted out recently. They basically, they had a white guy walk down the street with an AR-15, and the cop comes up. He's like, why are you walking around with this AR-15? And he's like, oh, I'm just exercising my Second Amendment rights, and I'm allowed to, so I am. And it's like, and then he's like, well, let me see ID. And he's like, no, I don't have to do that, so I'm not going to. And he's like, well, you got me there. Bye. Off he goes. Black guy walks with an AR-15, makes like 20 feet. Before the guns are drawn, the guy gets down on the ground. You hear the girl who's taking the video screaming like, I'm a pregnant woman and I'm videotaping this. And he's like, lay down. He's like, I'm pregnant. You're like, then sit on the curb. The gun stays out. Three more patrol cars show up and all this stuff. So at any rate, obviously right now it's a big deal with, you know, the very difficult situation we have with the increasing militarization of United States Police Department, and I'm only a bit of the way in on Rise of the Warrior Cop, and I'm already thrilled that so much of it does not take place. I expected it to be like from hit the ground running, like, so anyway, this is all the this is all, you know, because of the drug war and the Reagan era, whatever, this, that, and the other, and he doesn't. It's like I'm a third of the way in, and we're just barely wrapping our minds around what it means to have a police force at all. You know, in the beginning days, there was no police. There was an army. You could have armies. And the question was, like, could you send armies in to handle things like capture escaped slaves? He's explaining how police forces essentially had three. There was how they handled police forces in the Northeast, which largely was, you know, when a big problem happened, you would have citizens who would, you know, get the town riled up and go do something about it. You had the way early police happened in the South, which was almost exclusively to capture escaped slaves or to prevent a slave rebellion. And then you had the way sheriffs and so on handled things in the Western territories, which was, you know, very spread out, and it tended to be on a very one-by-one contract basis. It's fascinating. I'm really, really digging it. And Radley Balko is a talented writer. And I recommend that you guys join me on the journey of reading Rise of the Warrior Cop.
Interesting. Oh, that is a very complex subject.
I know. Well, that's my only thesis is, why don't you take the trip with me? Because it's like,
yeah, I mean, Balko's an interesting writer. I've been following him for years, and he is a very, 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 and it's a very interesting and is certainly the evolution of policing of what it's gone through. Sort of, you said to, well, I guess they should intervene in domestic calls when a man hits a woman, and I guess they should intervene in these other things that you never would have thought that government should step into, and now is right thinking moral citizens. Well, of course you've got to protect these people. Of course you've got to do this. And then community policing, and you get so many of these conflicts in places where, well, these cops probably didn't want to be there, but they had to be there.
And it's so like you can see, and again, you know, like any complicated topic, you know, it's presented very much as a collage of disparate images. You know, on the one hand, for example, just now, like last week in the news, was $1 million settlement lawsuit because some cops got the wrong address and they threw in a flashbang grenade that landed in a crib with a toddler and exploded. And
cop deaths are way up.
Well, exactly. You know, and that's the flip side, right? Is that it's like nobody's saying, or certainly I'm not saying it's a simple issue one way or the other. But it's, I don't know, it's fascinating and terrifying. and also important with a capital I, so I'm reading it.
On a related note, I have my pick, and somewhat tangentially connected to this, a friend of mine recommended I watch this. He says, have you seen this thing? I'm like, no. He's like, Chris Kenner said, have you seen it? I'm like, it's like, oh, you got to see this. You've got to see this. I'm like, really? All right.
I can totally see Kenner doing that, by the way.
I click. I start watching. I'm, you know, opening. I'm like, oh, it's kind of clever. Minute in. I'm like, oh, this is kind of cool. 2 minutes in. I'm like, well, that's interesting. And then I'm going to tell you, and I'm going to give you a little bit of a spoiler on it. It's not a ruining thing for it. It's the documentary, The Grim Sleeper. All right, Tale of the Grim Sleeper, which is about a serial killer who was in Southeast Central LA, who for 25 years murdered women who were largely prostitutes, who were addicted to crack cocaine, and who were marginalized. And there's some very big criticisms are made against the police department, and there may be some validity to it. I think they make a very compelling case, but you always want to hear the other story side to it. But the allegation is that the police, you know, that they had a composite sketch that they never released. They have one victim who survived, who actually took the police to a house that ended up being three doors down from the guy they finally arrested in 2010. Remember, this started back in the 1980s. They finally arrested this guy then, you know, 25 years later, and it turns out they were brought three houses away. And I could write a book about close calls, about how many times police have come so close, have answered the door, they have the suspect in front of them. And again, they deal with hundreds of suspects all the time. So it's not, you know, it's easy for us to go pick back. But the story that unfolds, the very beginning in this documentary, there's the woman, Pamela, who is a former prostitute, who, you know, we're seeing a video image here of a frame grab from her. Let me tell you what happened. So it opens up, the guy in the back, the documentary, he goes to LA to go to investigate, you know, find out about the story. He's in front of the house where the serial killer was found. He's talking to a couple women, ask them, do you know about the Grim, you know, Sleeper? Do you know about this guy? And this woman says, I knew him, or I dated him, or whatever. And across the street, somebody starts yelling at him, you know, going, Peckerwood, which is, you know, slang for, you know, Whitey or something. But anyhow, and I'm thinking, well, if I were as a documentary producer myself, I'm like, well, this is when I get into the van and we go back to the production office and we figure out how to put this thing together just using archival footage. He goes across the street to go talk to these men who are yelling at him, who are you know, accosting him. It turns out they are friends with the alleged killer, and you know, they're like, well, we think that, you know, the police already called him. The trial hasn't happened yet. They call him this. It's already been prejudiced. This is Nick Broomfield, by the way, who produced this. And I wouldn't say hostile at this point. They're telling him their side of the story. A few minutes later in the documentary, and then, well, so-and-so who we just spoke with contacted us, and he wanted to go explain more. These three guys who started off by yelling at the documentarians start coming in, and the story really begins to unfold. They take over the narrative almost. And then Pamela, who is one of these people they talked to who had known him, she says, well, I can help you talk to so-and-so. I can help you talk. They're driving along the street. She starts yelling at some girls, prostitute, like, did you know the Grim Sleeper? Like, no, I didn't know him. It's like, all right, goes on. She becomes they end up giving her a job as the coordinator because she's able to get all these interviews and put this whole thing together. It's amazing. And it just, the people of the community start to tell this story. And it's a very tragic story of all these victims of people we look the other way. And they mention a quote, like an acronym that the police would use where they would, when a prostitute would get killed, was that they weren't a human. And when you meet Pamela, who is an amazing, fascinating person, you realize if she had been born 10 miles to the north, her life would have turned out very, very different. The same with many of these other women who were born into a community that was plagued with, you know, a number of problems for a variety of reasons. But the point is, the people you meet are very human. They're very real, and it's very sympathetic. Rather than watching through your, you know, conventional on the news, you hear about this thing that goes there, and you think, well, that's those people. It makes it real. And so Tales of the Grim Sleeper on HBO. OMG, I highly, highly, highly recommend this.
Wow. So this is one of those cases where, you know, oftentimes people will be super enthusiastic and you'll get through it. You're like, oh, yeah, no, it was good. It was good. But in this case, you've become a full convert. You are a Kennerist.
It started off with, you know, so many documentaries. Like there's this, the Michael Moore, I just wanted to ask some questions. No, you had an agenda. You right. had an agenda you wanted to go do. And we all do. But to pretend that you don't, you know, is deceptive. And I find that so manipulative, and I get frustrated when people like documentaries like Gaslandia and things like that. And I backed out of participating in a documentary. I will not name it right now, but it's getting a lot of attention, you know, by an Academy Award winning documentarian, because I saw how manipulative they were behind the scenes. And I said, you know, what about this? They're like, and I'm like, I can't be involved, because I get it. I think when you embrace the lie to tell the truth, you're not telling the truth.
Well,
with Broomfield, I don't know what he set out to do, but this documentary, from the way it appears, took on a life of its own, and it's amazing.
Well, and here's the thing, is documentaries are inherently very, very problematic, because real life is not nearly as interesting or is far more complex, to the point where it distracts from what we expect in an hour and a half story, a visual story. You know, there is just kind of an expectation that we have, which is why you have, you know, who's the guy who does the PBS documentaries on, like,
Ken Burns.
Ken Burns takes a million years to tell this big sweeping story and just demands, all right, have patience. We're going to unfold this big historical thing. When you get into documentaries about things that are happening in the modern era, rare are those that can make the compelling story without taking shortcuts. Rarer still are the ones that can make the journey into this story itself something amazing. And, you know, the documentary that I would – and I'll tell you what, this will be my pick. I think it's probably my pick before. But in a similar vein, Dear Zachary is a story that is a very personal story. You know, I don't think it makes – any bones about where its point of view is from, but the point of the movie is that it's a guy whose friend is dead, and he never got to meet his son. So he's a newborn son. And so it's him going around to all these different, all of his different friends, guys that knew his the young boy's father, and telling him just about the father. And that would be an interesting story in and of itself. Where it goes is jaw-dropping. And I suspect that there is a similar link between this and the Grim Sleeper, although I have not seen the Grim Sleeper yet.
Yes. It is. It's that when you let the story, when you dig, and I think Broomfield went where other people would fear to tread. You went into an area, a neighborhood that, you know, if you're walking around with your white guy with a film crew, that you would encounter some skepticism and whatnot from people, and they had to be careful about what they do. And there's a point where he's talking to somebody just randomly in the back alley of something, and there are gunshots, and the guy he's talking to just runs, you know? And it's like,
yeah.
You know, it's a, you know, and obviously they chose that because it's interesting and compelling, but this is a real thing. But it just... The thing that really struck me was...
Doggone it. I just realized that I just looked at the IMDb here for Dear Zachary, and then I see the words $0.00 with Prime Instant Video. Kind of don't have an excuse not to jump on the Dear Zachary chain now. Dang it.
Well, I mean, you also are a subscriber to HBO. So
yes. No.
No money down.
Yeah. No, I'm in. I have to be in on all that. Wow.
Yeah.
But it's
so
like,
anyhow. And it's, I'm, you know, when you watch it, be mindful that, you know, in the case of Tales of the Grim Sleeper, is that it's very critical on the LAPD, which, you know, it's a big agency and does some things that deserving of criticism. But also you have to understand, when you talk about the problems of policing, this is a community that has historically had issues with the police and historically felt that cooperating is not in the best interest. And, you know, there's a woman who makes a very good case talking about, like, well, my son has a problem. I tell him not to call 911 because when the police answer the door, they're going to question him, start asking him things, and it may cause problems. And you get into this and you understand that it's a complex issue. And if you're an investigator trying to investigate this case, it's hard to proceed, not to say that mistakes weren't made. It's complicated, but.
Obviously, listen, we are late into the show, but to get into something that, you know, this complex, but I will just add to say that this is tremendously difficult to parse. And also, when it comes to law enforcement, I believe that they have a unfairly hard and difficult job, and they deserve our tremendous and I think to a certain extent unconditional respect. But however, with that kind of power comes a demand for you know, double checking the work, and you know, yeah. I think it is a trust but verify situation, and as much as you know, I have tremendous great respect. You know, my stepdad's family were all cops in Pittsburgh. You know, at the same time, you got to make sure, like when you have the ability to shoot somebody and go home and sleep with your wife and kids at night, that you need to be able to double check and verify. You know, to a degree that we don't double check and verify even other public servants.
You know, and a thing to point out too is that in many cities, like in Fort Lauderdale, they have a citizens review board. So when somebody's accused, the cops are accused of doing, things, you know, wrong, unprofessional, whatever, acts, whatever. There's a group of citizens that weigh in on these things. And a lot of cities have this stuff. There are ways to get involved if you're concerned about policing. And one of the things I encourage, if you ever have the opportunity to go on a ride along with the cop, do it. It is life changing when you understand what it is like from that point of view.
Did you know? Have you done that? What was that like?
Oh, I mean, I grew up in a family of cops. Yeah, you see that, you know, 90% of it is, you know, it's domestic disturbance calls, and then it's the, hey, we heard a noise in back of the building, we don't know what it is. One guy, we need you, one guy by yourself to go back there and go look at it, because maybe somebody's got a gun and they're breaking in. I don't know, but I'm too afraid to go. But you go do it, and we forget. That's what their nights are like all the time. And you know, we can be frustrated by the power they get to wield and the authority they get to. And that needs to be questioned and challenged and all these things. But also when you think about the fact that, like, if you think something dangerous is about to happen, you hear a noise, you send them, you know, and it's like, yep, I got to go back there. I don't want to go there. You know, then they wear rubber gloves because they've got to empty the pockets out of junkies and people like that. And, you know, I've had, you know, my brother's a cop, like, yep, had to go to the hospital. I had to get a hepatitis test because I got pricked by a needle, you know, and it's just, it's like, holy cow, you know, like how many times stuff like that happens. And you just, it's easy to forget, you know, that it's not a fun, you know, and
by
I've
the,
had.
By the way, how fascinating is it that that after spending 40 minutes dancing on the edge of a artistic vision of an abyss without any government or any of the trappings of society, we immediately retreat to current life and be like, yeah, so anyway, police, that's complicated, right? All of our picks are about the fringes of society now, which, by the way, we're all really glad that we have these sociological constructs all around us.
Man, like, here's the thing. Society's hard. Like, it really is hard. It is hard to keep powerful megalomaniacs from hoarding all the water and driving us into servitude. Like, it is really, 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 really difficult to keep this whole thing. Like, the world, Western civilization is like a debutante. It takes a lot of effort to get to look this good. Like, you need to have constant maintenance.
I've been in the middle of writing a book. I've got Amazon Prime boxes piled up. I haven't taken out the trash. Like, my pocket of the world that I am responsible for, my portion of society that Andrew is supposed to look at, is falling apart, guys. It is just falling apart here. I don't know how the world works. I'm amazed that there aren't, you know, the streets aren't filled with guys and bikers and leather outfits and stuff and war boys and blood. I just, if it were left to me, in my neglectful nature, we'd all be doomed.
I think that about sums it up, doesn't it?
Yes. It's been mad.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.